Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's episode. Today, we're going to be tackling one of the most common and often overlooked conditions in primary care, which is MASLD. And that stands for Metabolic Dysfunction Associated Steatotic Liver Disease. With rising rates of obesity and diabetes, as well as metabolic syndrome, liver disease isn't just a hepatology problem anymore. It's showing up every day in our primary care clinics. So in this short session, we have Dr. Neem Ha, who is a transplant hepatologist and assistant professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, joining us today. And we'll be breaking down the key signs you might miss when diagnosing MASLD, how to screen efficiently, and any practical management tips you can start using right away when you're seeing your patients. So our main goal for this session is to help you catch liver disease early and make liver health a routine part of the chronic disease care. So thank you, Dr. Ha, for joining us today. I just want to start off just kind of asking about labs, because that's one of the first things that we look at when we see patients. Often we see very mild lab abnormalities in primary care. How should clinicians interpret these elevated liver enzymes, particularly when patients feel completely asymptomatic?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that the common trend is MASLD. Yes, it's a very common disease in the world. It happens about 25 to 30% of the population globally, and among those with diabetes, that rate goes up to 45 to 50%. And sometimes when patients present to your primary care clinic, sometimes their abnormal ALTs can occur. But to actually interpret it in the right clinical setting is really important. So sometimes when we think about MASLD, I really think MASLD is one of those things where it's found in the primary care clinic and it's usually identified by primary care providers first. But it's usually linked to sort of metabolic syndrome, such as obesity, as well as hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and diabetes, as well as other subtle signs like, say, obstructive sleep apnea or endocrine pathology. So when you take in consideration the elevated labs, as well as one, the pattern, and two, the degree of elevation within the right patient phenotype, it can help you narrow your differential and diagnosis. So I think for me, MASLD or metabolic dysfunction that's associated with steatotic liver disease is one of a illness that really needs to rule out any underlying sort of comorbidities. So I think that what we can do is you usually send the typical workup. This can be some viral hepatitis to rule out the typical hepatitis B as well as hepatitis C. And depending on your patient's age as well as degree of elevation of enzyme, you can make a decision to send an autoimmune serology, to rule out autoimmune hepatitis, or other cholestatic diseases such as primary biliary cholangitis or even primary sclerosis cholangitis. And then we also look at patients in terms of their alcohol contents, in terms of how much they use. And it's really important to quantify the alcohol use depending on the patient's sex. So the cutoff for men and women are completely different in terms of what's considered harmful and unharmful use. For example, men can take up to weekly intake of 210 to 420 grams, or daily intakes of 30 to 60 grams, versus women is a little lower at 140 to 350 grams per week, or 20 to 50 grams per day. And after you rule out all those other sort of viral pathologies, autoimmune, cholestatic, or inherited disease, and also alcohol, then we can think about, okay, is this elevated liver enzyme really due to metabolic dysfunction? And that's when we can look at other factors, and then the workup really begins.
Okay, that's great. So just to summarize, when you have patients with elevated liver enzymes, typically the first thing to do would rule to be ruling out certain conditions that you can actually exclude based on just blood work. So like hepatitis B, hepatitis C, autoimmune hepatitis, and certain hereditary conditions of the liver. And of course, alcohol is a common cause of liver enzyme elevation. So making sure that alcohol doesn't play a role. What about when patients also have metabolic syndrome? So diabetes, insulin resistance, obesity, does that ever change your threshold in evaluating liver disease? Like, do you see these patients and say, oh, they have Mazzled, or do you still kind of go through this whole workup?
That's a really great question. So I think for me, mast cell rarely exists in isolation. Most patients have at least one of metabolic conditions, often type 2 diabetes, obesity, or dyslipidemia. So if they have these phenotypes, then I think that I would narrow the diagnosis a little. It makes it easier. And then therefore, you don't have to run a full panel of workup. But I still think it's important, for example, in the younger patients. If someone has fatty liver disease that doesn't have the typical phenotypical signs and doesn't have the typical metabolic syndrome that we're accustomed to seeing, I really think it's important to make sure we rule out inherited disease, like for example, Wilson's. If you look at the guidelines for AASLD in the small asterisk area, they want you to rule out, again, the typical viral as well as autoimmune inherited before making and concluding a diagnosis of fatty liver disease. But yeah, you're right though. If someone's coming in with a lot of metabolic syndrome, obesity, particularly type 2 diabetes, and their liver enzymes are mildly elevated, is it necessary to set up every single workup for autoimmune pathologies or, say, alpha-1 antitrypsin or even ceruloplasmin? It may not within that same context.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So it's you still take it within the context of the whole patient, but I think it's important to stay mindful that we really should be ruling out other conditions before nailing it down to MASLD. Although when people have many of the metabolic syndrome risk factors, it seems like it's most likely they're going to have MASLD, but certainly if we want to be completely sure of that diagnosis, we should exclude other conditions. Okay, perfect. I just wanted to move on. Let's say you do diagnose a patient with MASLD. So they have metabolic risk factors, they don't have that much alcohol intake, and they have imaging that supports the presence of fat in the liver. What would be the next step at that point? Can you talk to us a little bit about the FIB-4 score and how we can just easily use that during a visit?
Yeah, so now that we have a leading diagnosis or leading hypothesis for this elevated liver enzyme in this patient, I think it's really important to think about different things and different diagnostic tools we have. So I kind of categorize them as like imaging as well as non-invasive labs as well as we talked about lab markers and liver enzymes. So I think imaging, I think it's important to at least get an ultrasound when someone has elevated liver enzymes. Just make sure you're not missing anatomical abnormality or a, say, for example, biliary issue or maybe a mass that could be present. I think with the ultrasound, you can tell a lot by how the liver looks, the contour of the liver, and can kind of narrow in if there's any evidence of steatosis. Now, sometimes when you think about these old imaging modalities, there's a component to it called elastography. And I think the elastography is the modality of imaging that actually can tell you how much fat or how much stiff deliver it is, but it's really important to be mindful to understand like when you order this imaging modality, each elastography cut points are different, say for ultrasound, for CAT scan, or for MRI. And I think that the one that most hepatologists use, if available, is FibroScan because it has the most robust data in trying to identify what's if someone has severe steatosis or fat, and then the degree of scarring in the liver. And we can help break it down to is it none to minimal fibrosis? Is it advanced fibrosis or are we concerned for cirrhosis? And I think that if those are not available and sometimes they take long to order or get the patients, then the FIB-4 becomes really helpful. FIB-4 combines four things: age, liver enzymes, as well as platelet counts. And it was initially developed to evaluate the advanced risk factors or advanced fibrosis in the hepatitis C population, but it's now been adapted to the mast cell. And it's really important to when you identify where you calculate the FIB-4 to understand the cut points. I do think that the cut points are usually more reliable in patients ages 35 to 65 years old. And usually the cut point that most guidelines really rely on is if there's less than 1.3 to rule out any advanced fibrosis, and anything more than that warrants really additional workup. And when you think about the FIB-4 score in general, age is part of the equation. So for patients who are 65 and older, I do think that it's important to use like a more conservative cut points, which is two, in order to minimize, false positive.
Right. Yeah. I think that's really important that I think a FIB-4 is a really good tool to use to risk stratify, but it's not as accurate for everybody. So particularly for older patients or really young patients. And then it sounds like you can use the FIB-4 score to in terms of risk stratifying and also to determine whether or not you should refer. It seems like we see a lot of patients who have high FIB-4 scores. Do you think that it's a good idea to use a FIB-4 score for making the decision regarding referral, or are there any kind of other tips that you might use for primary care physicians other than the FIB-4 score in certain instances where they should just refer to hepatology or gastroenterology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that, for as hepatologists, we really rely on the primary care colleagues because this is a, primary care issue. It's the fatty liver disease is just really the metabolic manifestation of metabolic syndrome. So, most of the identification or screening of patients in terms of low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk is going to be done in the primary care sector. So, for example, if there was a concern for a FIB-4, in the sense that it was intermediate or advanced or high risk for advanced fibrosis, and those patients I think that would warrant a referral to hepatology for additional imaging or testing. And these additional imaging and testing are what we kind of talked about before, is making a decision whether we do a CAT scan with elastography or MRI with elastography, or do they need a liver biopsy. And I think the FIB-4 is helpful in that part. I think if anything that's sort of low risk, like cutoff we use is less than 1.3 for patients 35 to 65, or less than 2 for patients 65 and greater. I think those patients can actually stay in the primary care setting and then just have FIB-4 recalculated, once every 1 or 2 years for diabetes, or maybe every 2 to 3 years for non-diabetic patients. For patients who are high risk, now those are the ones that I do think that warrants a referral to hepatology for further management and also positioning of therapies. And sometimes the red flags that I kind of tell my primary care colleagues are, again, the FIB-4 being high risk. If you notice that the platelets are trending down, which can be a marker for maybe a more advanced disease or portal hypertension, and if there's imaging findings that are concerning for you, if there's nodularity, if there's recanalization of umbilical vein, if there's a large spleen, and if there's any, of course, lesions that they find on imaging, those are other things that we can refer. And also, like, when things don't make sense. So you may think that this is diagnosis of mast cell, but sometimes your clinical gestalt is like, this is not making sense in terms of this patient phenotype and also the level and degree of the elevated liver enzymes. I think those also warrant additional testing. And I think that the one thing that I want to highlight for the primary care, the folks listening, is say, usually when you have intermediate high risk, it requires an extra modality. But I forgot to mention one thing was the biomarker. There is this thing called enhanced liver fibrosis, which is a non-invasive imaging or non-invasive, sorry, blood test to assess the severity of liver fibrosis. And it measures sort of special molecules in the blood that is associated with liver fibrosis, and it combines it with a single score to actually help primary care providers as well as other providers maybe better characterize patients who may not be have accessible to imaging modality.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I've been using the enhanced liver fibrosis blood test more often now too, as just another data point to help assess whether or not these patients have a lot of fibrosis, and then that helps determine how obviously we manage them. And thank you for bringing up the red flags too, because sometimes it can be a little tricky to decide who to refer and who to kind of just continue to monitor. But I would say there's probably never a wrong time to refer, especially if you're worried about a patient. Let's just move on to this last session or section in terms of management. So, you've diagnosed with pa this patient with MASLD. Thankfully, you did a FIB-4, it was low. And so There's low concern for advanced fibrosis, and you continue to monitor. But usually when patients hear there's something wrong with their liver, they get really, really anxious, rightfully so. So what are some tips that you might have when you talk to patients about fatty liver or steatosis in a way that might not be so alarming to them?
Yeah, I think that's a great segue. So you brought the word fibrosis and the referral. I think that for me, the whole aspect of when to refer or when not to refer is your degree of concern if someone has fibrosis or advanced fibrosis or just maybe approaching advanced fibrosis. And the reason why that's important is just how you counsel your patients. I think that the first thing is to normalize what's going on. Just because of how common the disease is. I always use stats. I say 1 in 3 people have the disease. If you have diabetes, 1 in 5, just to kind of normalize the setting and make sure to just kind of reassure and calm the nerves. And then I also think it's really important if it's just steatosis without any concern for advanced fibrosis, I really think that's something that we should really share with our patients. Because when you think about multiple epidemiology studies or just long-term outcomes, most of the patients with just steatosis without any fibrosis, the scarring component part of it, they have their same risk as any other metabolic factors. They are at increased risk for heart attacks, strokes, as well as age-related cancer. So the things that you would do naturally for all your other metabolic syndrome is the same approach for fatty liver disease. However, when someone has fibrosis, which we're trying to prevent, that's when the prognosis kind of shifts. And I think that's the reason why we really want any patient with concern for advanced fibrosis to see us, because then we can maybe better position patients in terms of therapy or upcoming therapies or even clinical trials. So I do think that the first thing is to normalize. The second thing is to really share them your risks and their your concerns. If it's just steatosis, then we have time and we can prevent long-term outcomes. Now, if it's fibrosis, then I also even try to break it down to, is this early or is it late? And if it's early, then our focus should be preventing advanced or late fibrosis. And now if it's late, then our focus should be how to prevent complications of portal hypertension or decompensation. So the goal shifts each time depending on where the patient presents.
Yeah, I like what you said about normalizing having fatty liver, because it really is just kind of taking care of another chronic condition. And thankfully now it seems like we have more tools in our toolbox to reduce fat in the liver, reduce inflammation, and even reduce fibrosis, which is what we'll talk about later on in the other podcast episodes. But aside from talking about just therapy and medication, what do you generally recommend to patients just in terms of lifestyle changes?
Lifestyle modification still remains our cornerstone of fatty liver disease, as well as the first line therapy. And, I think it's most effective to reduce the liver fat in general, as well as the inflammation, especially in early stages. And, there's not really a single quote unquote liver pill yet. So lifestyle, again, remains the first and most powerful tools to really stop and reverse this process. So some of the things I recommend to my patients are I like concrete recommendations. So sometimes our patients come to ask us what can they do? And we set them with concrete goals and tasks. They're more likely to accomplish them. So I usually look at their weight and I calculate what's necessary to lose. And usually that weight loss is up to 5 to 7%. That's been proven to actually resolve inflammation, resolve fat in the And also, for some patients with fibrosis, half of them also regress if you achieve this 5 to 7% weight loss. So then I calculate their weight, I give them a target goal each visit, and while also normalizing that weight loss is hard. And then we don't have to get all of it in one chunk, but can work on it for the next 6 to 12 months. And then for those with more advanced fibrosis or motivated, I shift the weight loss goal to even greater than 10%. And not everyone will achieve this, but greater than 10% has been really proven to have the most reliable metric in terms of just completely resolving fat as well as resolving fibrosis 4 out of 5 times. So I talk about the weight loss and then how you and I talk about methods of weight loss. I talk about diet. And usually sometimes patients always ask me what's the best diet. And I think that unfortunately we may not have the best data for every single diet, but we do have enough for a Mediterranean style of diet, and which is rich in vegetables as well as healthy fats, like olive oil or lean protein, whole grains. And for those patients who may not be able to accomplish the Mediterranean diet, I just tell them to do a caloric reduction of about 30% of what they usually takes. And I also try to tell them to get rid of the low-hanging fruits. I mean, like things that we can get rid of easily, reducing processed sugars as well as especially fructose that are found in sodas and fruit juice, as well as processed carbs. And then from the physical activity aspect, I don't just tell them to increase working out. That doesn't really work. But I tell them, hey, I look at their what they do, what they normally do. Do they walk? Do they run? Do they like to swim? And depending on what kind of activity you do, I can categorize them into moderate versus vigorous. I think it's really important to help your patients in terms of categorizing what's considered moderate vigorous because each of them have a different goal. So if patients who have moderate exercise, their goal is 100 to 150 to 200 minutes per week. And for patients with vigorous exercise, their goal is really just 75 to 150 minute weeks in 3 to 5 sessions, in order to improve both their metabolic health as well as their musculoskeletal health. And studies have shown that even rigorous exercise is able to decrease the inflammation as well as the fat in the liver, even in the absence of weight loss. So in summary, I really tell them, I give them tools, and I give them tools that I've been proving to help with their disease and concrete goals for them to achieve.
Yeah, I find that for some of my patients, at least, they feel more motivated, especially when we say that fat in the liver is reversible, and even some degree of scarring or fibrosis is reversible, and that really helps with their weight loss journey. And it's definitely a journey. It's certainly not easy to lose weight, especially when there's competing demands between work and family and other stressors. So it's not easy. I want to wrap up, and because this episode is focused mostly on how primary care clinicians can diagnose MASLD more easily, or at least just think about it more and kind of make it part of their routine chronic disease management. Are there a couple of like one or two things they can ask a patient or be mindful of at each visit? Because we know that primary care physicians are so busy, and there's so many different things to address. So now we have to add to that on top of everything else, looking at MASLD, but maybe just one or two quick things they could just check off their checklist, that could help to diagnose MASLD or just even monitor MASLD.
Yeah, I think the first thing is it's all about screening and identifying this patient at risk earlier. So I'll say screening at-risk patients. And these are the patients we talked about. These are the patients with associated risk factors of obesity, metabolic syndrome. And how common it is with diabetes as well as just obesity in general. So just to think about it and screen for it, I think that itself is a lot. And then also look at different populations. So I think that certain populations are impacted a little more. Like for example, our Hispanic and Latino communities, I feel like they have the highest prevalence and sometimes combination of genetic factors as well as environmental factors. So looking for family history to also identify these patients, even if they don't have the phenotypical obesity or metabolic syndrome, is something really helpful. And I think that if we can identify these patients who are at risk for fatty liver disease or maybe approaching advanced fibrosis, we can make a big difference because if we could address it now, then we can reverse any chance that they may have progression of disease and prevent cirrhosis or even downstream complications. And we can make a big impact on our patients' lives. I think some of the tools that we have offered is we talked about today, using the labs wisely in the correct setting, as using your FIB-4 as something that's readily available that you have labs available for you to really further risk stratify your patients in front of you. And to also, reach out to us if you ever need help from your specialist.
Yeah, thanks for that. I also think it's important to just remember that MASLD can be a team, a whole team effort, you know, between the hepatologist, endocrinologist, the primary care physician, the dietitian. It definitely takes a lot of people to help this condition because it's not just, it's very multifaceted. So thank you so much, Dr. Ha, for joining us today, and hopefully you guys will be able to join us for our other podcast sessions focusing on MASLD. Thank you.